From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In Thailand, they're fighting the spread of HIV/AIDS any way they can. Traffic cops hand out prophylactics, and there's a restaurant chain called Cabbages and Condoms. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist John Cohen about efforts to stem the tide of HIV in Asia. He visited six countries and wrote a four-part series for the journal Science. Also, we talk with film director Bronwyn Hughes about the cop-turned-bank robber who became a folk hero in South Africa. It's the subject of our new film, Stander. And music critic Milo Miles reviews Five Guys Walk Into a Bar. It's a new box set reissue of music by the band Faces. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. U.S.-led troops appear to be getting ready for a major offensive in Najaf, but as NPR's Ivan Watson reports, while the Iraqi interim government has taken a tough verbal stand against insurgents, there appears to be some debate within the government on how to actually handle them.
Today, the deputy president of the Iraqi government, Ibrahim Jafari, who is a member of a prominent Shiite political party, called for foreign forces in Najaf to pull out of that city. And he appealed to Iraqis to have only Iraqi troops to be fighting in that area. And this is a voice of dissent coming from within Alawi's own government. Suggests there may be some cracks, some divisions within his own government as it tries to take a hard line against one of its opponents.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from Baghdad. In Fallujah, a hotbed of resistance to the U.S., American planes bombed several houses today. Hospital officials say at least four people were killed. A new Pentagon audit could spell more trouble for a Halliburton subsidiary that has huge contracts in Iraq. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has details.
The Halliburton subsidiary, KBR, has already billed the U.S. government more than $4 billion for its work feeding and housing U.S. troops in Iraq and Kuwait. Pentagon auditors, in a report dated August 2nd, criticized the way the company produces its cost estimates. That's important because the cost estimate helps determine the fee the company can charge in a cost-plus-fee contract. Auditors gave KBR 45 days to correct the problems they found. The Pentagon could withhold payments to KBR, but has not done so. A Halliburton spokeswoman said KBR disputed the Pentagon report's finding that KBR's cost estimate system is inadequate. She said the company will respond in time and remains committed to supplying U.S. troops in Iraq. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The two leaders of the 9/11 Commission were back on Capitol Hill today, testifying before the House Intelligence Committee and pressing again for creation of a new Director of Intelligence post. Defense Department officials expressed concern that the intelligence director could have too much power, but Commission Chairman Thomas Kane compared the position to a football quarterback who has a broad view of action on the field. Vice Chairman Lee Hamilton said a national intelligence director would not get in the way of the military as it fights a war on terrorism. Florida Congressman Porter Goss, President Bush's pick to head the Central Intelligence Agency, said today he's stepping down as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee while his nomination is being considered. He said he'll continue as a member of the committee. Two tropical weather systems are headed toward Florida. Hurricane Charley could reach the lower Florida Keys tomorrow and make landfall on the southwestern mainland Friday. Tropical Storm Bonnie is expected to hit the Florida Panhandle early tomorrow morning. Wall Street, the Dow down 6 points today at 99.38, the Nasdaq down 26 at 17.82. This is NPR News. President Bush is campaigning in the western U.S. today. He's being joined on a 9-state tour by Arizona Senator John McCain. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Mark Moran reports.
George Bush and John McCain were rivals in the Republican presidential primary 4 years ago, and after losing to Mr. Bush, McCain expressed only tepid support for the eventual nominee. The Arizona senator has been nearly as vocal as some Democrats in his criticism of the Bush administration's policies. But McCain is traveling with Mr. Bush in support of a second term for the president, and the two embraced at a rally in Florida. A statement from McCain's office says that while the two might not see eye to eye on all matters, the senator and the president do agree that the number one issue facing the nation is the threat of terrorism. President Bush will be introduced to a crowd of 14,000 supporters at the State Fairground Coliseum here by baseball star Luis Gonzalez, who plays for the Arizona team. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
Democrat John Kerry has been campaigning in Nevada today and focusing hard on health care. Starting a new push for support from seniors, he said President Bush is standing in the way of lower drug prices for seniors by not allowing imports of prescription drugs from Canada. The Bush campaign responded, saying the president opposes drug imports for safety reasons. Kerry also talked of Social Security and retirement.
I will never privatize Social Security. I will not cut the benefits, and I will not raise the retirement age in this country, period.
President Bush won Nevada in 2000 and plans to make a third trip there tomorrow. Today's visit was also Kerry's third trip to the state. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Amundsen Foundation, for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Last December, the premier of China, Wen Jiabao, did something regarded as extraordinary. He allowed himself to be photographed greeting a former taxi driver from Shanxi province who's being treated for AIDS. The event signaled the awakening of the Chinese government to the threat HIV poses to its 1.3 billion people at a time when countries across Asia are hoping to avoid the catastrophic AIDS epidemic that has befallen sub-Saharan Africa. My guest, writer John Cohen, recently published a four-part series on AIDS in Asia for the journal Science. In researching the series, Cohen traveled to six countries, talking to doctors, patients, public health officials, sex workers, and drug users. Cohen has been writing on the AIDS epidemic for 15 years. His book on the search for a vaccine is called Shots in the Dark. Cohen has also followed the AIDS crisis in Africa. I asked him how the situation in Asia compares.
Sub-Saharan Africa and Asia are remarkably different places, and it's even hard to talk about entire continents as one place. Africa is not one place. I mean, Africa has some countries that have high HIV prevalence, some that have low, and the same is true in Asia. But there are some stark differences between the continents, and I think it is fair to speak about them on that level. For one thing, there's nowhere in Asia that has a prevalence, that means the percentage of the people in a population who are infected, that comes anywhere near the high prevalence areas in Africa. So that's one very stark difference. In Botswana, for example, 38% of the adults are infected. South Africa, it's about 20% of the adults. The highest prevalence you see in Asia is right around 4%.
And does that mean that the growth of the virus can be stemmed in Asia? Are people optimistic?
People see a window of opportunity now in Asia that has closed in many African countries that have been hard hit. It also means that the patterns of spread differ in the two continents, and there are some sharp distinctions that are very real. Africa has, in the high prevalence areas, has a pattern of both men and women having concurrent sexual partners, meaning more than one partner in the same year. In Asia, by and large, you don't see many women who have several partners in the same year outside of sex workers. And that's one really critical factor that can drive an epidemic to much higher prevalence levels.
So that's simply a cultural difference?
Simply a cultural difference. Now, it's not true across the board. There are pockets here and there in Asia that look like Africa. But by and large, it is a fact that epidemiologists have begun to bring to light, and it steers how you deal with trying to prevent the spread. Let me give you another example. Africa really doesn't have much heroin, and that means there's not much sharing of needles and spreading the virus by that route of transmission. In Asia, 1 in 3 new infections is by sharing dirty needles. Heroin is all over the place in Asia. Afghanistan is the largest producer, followed by Burma, which the military junta has renamed Myanmar. Then Laos is third in line for producing heroin. So you see the spread through dirty needles all over Asia, and you don't see that in Africa.
Last December, the Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao was shown in the media visiting three AIDS patients. And I guess in China, if that's covered by the Chinese media, that's a clear shift in government policy. What prompted him to wake up and take that public gesture?
It was a hugely symbolic act that he did that. And You know, on the one hand, you might say, hey, it's 2003 when he did this. What's the big deal? He's shaking the hands of AIDS patients. But it was a big deal in China, where discrimination and stigma are very, very prevalent all over the country about HIV. And it was prompted by, I think, a confluence of events. One is China received a tremendous amount of criticism internationally for how it handled SARS and the outbreak, and by not more forthrightly dealing with the international community and the spread of that disease. Then the price of antiretroviral drugs, of anti-HIV drugs, has plummeted, which has forced countries all over the world to deal with the question of, are they going to offer those drugs to their people? There also was a change in leadership in China, and so I think the confluence of those things led China to really question its role in dealing with its own epidemic.
Now, wasn't there a scandal involving the transmission of the virus and blood selling? I mean, selling blood for money in China.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. That was another very big prod to the central government to change things. In China, many poor people sold their blood so that the plasma could be used elsewhere, and their blood was pooled and their red blood was put back in them, and they infected approximately 250,000 people is the best government estimate I've seen. And people were paid about $5 per donation. These are very poor farming communities mostly. And I visited some of those villages, and the level of devastation there is also just on an African scale.
Give us a picture of your visit to one of those villages.
Well, I went to a village where about 20 to 30% of the people are infected. The government is trying to get drugs to these people, HIV drugs to these people. The program is stumbling for a number of, I think, really sobering reasons that many people around the world could learn from. It's really hard to take a lot of pills every single day. And if you miss some pills, HIV will beat its way around the drugs and become resistant to the drugs. People also have side effects to the drugs. They're not anticipating these. And when they get them, they stop taking the medicine. That's happened all over these provinces in China that had the blood sellers receive treatment. And they don't have enough trained physicians who really understand how to use the drugs, what to do about side effects, and how to monitor people who are on them. So as much as the world would like to see poor people everywhere receive anti-HIV drugs who need them, the technical issues are staggering.
A lot of the drugs that are used to treat HIV and AIDS symptoms really work best if people have decent food and nutrition. How does poverty affect the ability of governments to treat AIDS with drugs?
You know, AIDS basically just picks the scab off the wounds of society. Certainly, if people have poor nutrition, their immune system isn't going to recover as well when you give them AIDS drugs. It's all connected. I mean, the same is true for clean water, which probably makes more people sick in the world than anything else. And if you need to drink water with your drugs, it's all connected. HIV is just exposing it. I don't see any way to separate it, and you just try to do the best you can in bad situations.
In the villages that you visited in China that had been ravaged by HIV, was there a different mix of young kids and old people and parents?
Who were infected?
Yeah, or that who were still around. I mean, did you find villages where there'd been a lot of deaths and you know, kind of decimation of the parent population?
I didn't see that so much, but I did see a lot of new orphanages being built, which is an indicator of that. I met with several people who were probably infected in the mid-1990s. So they, even without treatment, they'd only now just be getting sick. So again, it speaks back to how old is the epidemic. And it's not as though there were people dying in the rice fields as I walked around. They had started to deliver drugs to these people. So people, I mean, one woman I met with, she was bragging to me how she was chubby now. She pushed her cheeks. She said, look, I'm chubby. You don't often hear women bragging about being chubby. And her point was, these drugs have saved my life. You know, it's turned around my health completely. And I met more people who are on that course right now. But all of this is, you got to look at it at a snapshot in time. I mean, China is missing a key drug to treat HIV. It's called 3TC, simply because they have yet to work out a deal with the manufacturer, and they're not able, because of World Trade Organization policy, to purchase the generic version. Without that drug, you're going to see a lot of failure in the people receiving treatment in China. I think it's a catastrophe waiting to happen.
Why would the World Trade Organization policy prohibit China from purchasing the generic drug?
Well, there are patent laws, and each country signs on to the World Trade Organization at different points in time and agrees to observe world patents. Some countries signed on at different times and can produce these drugs generically without fear of being punished. China technically could do it through, there's a procedure where you could do a compulsory license in doing it, but some believe that China doesn't want to antagonize the big pharmaceutical companies, which are setting up quite an impressive beachhead in Shanghai.
One of the big problems in Southern Africa with the both the growth of the virus and treating it was the ostracism that faced people who were infected. Is that a big issue in Asian cultures as well?
Yes, absolutely. And it takes on a different face everywhere, but it's basically the same. People who are infected with HIV are stigmatized, and there's discrimination most everywhere I've been. In India, interestingly, women have a specific problem, because oftentimes a family will learn that a man is infected because his pregnant wife goes to the hospital to give birth and they test her. In traditional Indian society, women have arranged marriages and they live with the husband's parents. So the woman comes home from the hospital, and I met many women like this, says that she's HIV infected, and the family kicks her out, assuming that she's done something wrong, when in fact it's the husband who likely saw a sex worker or somehow had sex outside the marriage and brought the virus home.
So she's kicked out, and what becomes of her?
Well, I met with several women who had been kicked out and were taken in by their own parents again or other relatives. It's a horrible situation. I saw a lot of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, working with women who had been in this situation, trying to help them get back on their feet. I met with a group in Calcutta that specifically provides housing and helps these women find new jobs. It's one of these eye-popping things that I never imagined until I saw it up close.
My guest is writer John Cohen. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with writer John Cohen. He's recently completed a four-part series on AIDS in Asia for the journal Science magazine. Is it true that traffic cops in Thailand hand out condoms?
At times that happens. It's not I've never been handed a condom by a traffic cop in Thailand, and I've been there a number of times. So it happens, but it's not a big part of the strategy to deliver condoms. I mean, the strategy to deliver condoms is largely focused on sex workers. And basically, they are compelled to use condoms and to convince their clients to use condoms. And they have to do it with a high degree of unity, because if men know they can go down the block and have sex without a condom for a few more Thai baht, that's what they'll do. So you have to have a lot of unity in the sex worker community and in the brothel owners as well. They have to be pushing it. And I think that's really where Thailand has focused, in addition to having a senator, Meechai, who has started a chain of restaurants called Cabbages and Condoms, and he aggressively promotes condoms every chance he gets. You don't see many politicians around the world doing that.
Explain this, Cabbages and Condoms?
Yeah, it's a restaurant that the profits all go to supporting HIV prevention efforts. And the waiters sometimes blow up condoms and wear them on their head. And there are just condoms everywhere. So they make a condom as comfortable an item, as fun an item as like a party balloon or something. And Michai is famous for his antics. He's a colorful character. He's very smart. He's the son of two physicians. And he's written a book about all of this as well.
You mentioned that the key in Thailand was getting all of the sex workers, or most all of them, involved so that people couldn't go to a brothel down the street and have sex without a condom. How did the government do that? Was it a matter of grassroots organizing, coercion, both?
I think it was both. The sex worker industry in much of Asia is de facto illegal. But if you look more closely, you see that there are links to the government and to the police in particular in many regions. In some places, I've been told that the police own all the brothels and they're the landlords. I'm not saying that about Thailand, but Thailand certainly has had links between the police department and the brothels. So I think it's both the public health workers and the politicians and the police working through all different channels. Now, Thailand also has to keep up its guard. Their success story can evaporate quickly. And there are regions in Thailand that have not had success at all. And I was in the north with the Hill Tribe people, the Akha, and they don't have any of these services. They don't speak the Thai language. They don't have Thai citizenship. And there's a big problem in the northern region of Thailand with these disenfranchised people and HIV.
You mentioned that the country of Thailand had had a relatively successful campaign battling the growth of the HIV/AIDS problem. By contrast, the country of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, is ruled by a military dictatorship that took over in 1988. What did you find there?
Well, I toured the country, and I went officially again with a minder. And the healthcare system itself looks like it has AIDS. It's just a bare-bones system that has very little to offer anyone. Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has a clinic outside of Rangoon, now known as Yangon, that had started to treat people with anti-HIV drugs. They had 13 people on treatment, 1-3. In a country that probably has a higher prevalence than anywhere in Asia. Now, the junta has changed. There is a more aggressive campaign to prevent HIV spread and to help HIV-infected people. But, you know, the virus waits for no one, and it takes advantage of every misstep that politicians make. And the Burmese government, the junta in Myanmar, has allowed the virus to trample through much of the country unabated. And given the role of heroin and the gem mines there, it further exacerbates the situation greatly. It reminds me of South Africa. You know, South Africa has these diamond mines in the center of the country, and you see all this migration coming from both the east and the west coast. So typically men leave their girlfriends or spouses, their wives, and they go to the center of the country for 6 months, work in these mines, make all this money. There are lots of sex workers there, lots of drugs, lots of alcohol. It's a perfect environment for HIV. You see a very similar situation in Myanmar with the gem mines. They have ruby, jade, sapphire mines. And I met several men who go work at the mines for 3-4 months. There are a lot of sex workers there. If you have a good day, you make a tremendous amount of money. And what do you do at the end of the day? Well, you party with your friends. Maybe you smoke some heroin. Maybe you shoot some heroin. And maybe you hire a sex worker. That's life. And if you're going to really tackle HIV in Myanmar, that's where you've got to go. And I don't see much happening at those places, nor would they let me visit those places, to be frank. I mean, they didn't want me to see them.
Did you say you did speak with some gem mine workers, though?
I did, yes. I met gem mine workers who had become HIV infected at the mines, they believed, and they described the mines for me. And I mean, I was very near the mines. They just wouldn't let me go right to the mines. And they had a long list of reasons, some of which may have been valid. There's no telling when you're dealing with a government like that. I must say, the government let me in. You know, they let me in officially. Loads of journalists go there as tourists. I didn't want to do that. They were very accommodating to me, given their history and reputation with the media.
What did the gem mine workers tell you about what was going on there and their own knowledge of HIV when they were infected?
It was a good time. Knowledge of HIV was low. Many people in Asia and Africa learn about HIV after they become infected. They don't even know about the disease. It was a good time had by all. I mean, the descriptions I heard of the gem mines made it sound like the Wild Wild West.
Does the prevalence of HIV in that community pose a threat to other countries?
Sure. I mean, there have been studies that have looked at HIV spread outward from Myanmar, and that has done, the study did a molecular epidemiological analysis where they looked at the gene sequences of the HIV strains traveling around Asia, and they could map that the virus moved along the heroin trade routes from Myanmar in every direction. So certainly it spreads from there. I mean, I'm always hesitant to like place blame. It's not Myanmar's fault that there's HIV in Asia. There's HIV in Asia because there's HIV anywhere the virus can go, and it will simply take advantage of any situation it can. Heroin trade routes, that's a great situation for the virus. It wants to move around. It wants to copy itself. I think we always have to see the world of HIV through HIV's eyes, so to speak.
You've been writing about HIV/AIDS for 15 years, and I'm wondering how much hope, how much despair do you feel about where we are with this disease?
Well, I don't have a sunny personality where I look at everything and think, oh boy, this is great. I look at it critically. I have more hope now than I did a few years ago about poor people receiving treatment because the prices of drugs have plummeted and there's been the emergence of the Global Fund to treat AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, which is a revolutionary force. The search for a vaccine has always been first and foremost in my mind to stop the epidemic because I think that's the only true way to stop HIV. And it's moved slowly. It's been poorly organized. There is a movement afoot now to create what's called a vaccine enterprise to start steering the field. I'm optimistic that that could make a difference. But most everything moves too slowly with HIV. And as I mentioned earlier, the virus waits for no one. So I get really frustrated at how long it takes to do anything.
Well, John Cohen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Writer John Cohen. His four-part series on AIDS in Asia was published in the journal Science. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delacorte Press, publisher of Autumn Bridge, a novel set in 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka, author of Cloud of Sparrows, and from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Andre Stander was a legend in South Africa, the apartheid-era cop who turned against the system and became a notorious bank robber. His exploits are the subject of a new film. We'll talk with director Bronwyn Hughes. Also, critic Milo Miles reviews the new Faces box set, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. In the apartheid-era South Africa of the late 70s, one of Johannesburg's most celebrated police captains became the country's most notorious criminal. Detective Andre Stander was troubled by his experiences serving on riot control squads confronting black student protests, and he eventually started robbing banks, even while serving on the force. Once caught, he broke out of prison with two associates in 1983 and spent several months robbing more banks, changing disguises, embarrassing the police, and becoming a folk legend. Andre Stander's exploits are the subject of a new film by my guest, director Bronwyn Hughes. She got her start working with the offbeat Canadian comedy troupe, Kids in the Hall. She directed the children's film Harriet the Spy and was noticed by Steven Spielberg, who invited her to do a film for DreamWorks. That was Forces of Nature, starring Sandra Bullock and Ben Affleck. In Stander, the title role is played by Thomas Jane. Here he is in a scene which takes place in a bank he's just robbed in minimal disguise. He's with his police colleagues investigating his own crime, interviewing the teller.
I know. It's been a bad day. You okay now?
I'm sure, miss. Been through this over and over. But could you tell me exactly what she saw?
You.
Me.
I mean, I don't know what I mean. It's just, he was, you know, like you.
Want to take me in, Captain?
I asked director Bronwyn Hughes what she learned about what led Andre Stander astray.
Well, there are many conflicting opinions about it, because what people would know about him, they would have read in the press. And the press, of course, was owned by the government of South Africa at that time. And anything they could have read in the papers was not at all interested in a balanced or never mind sympathetic portrait of the man. So there are some people who, argue that he was just pure greedy. And however, I've been in South Africa meeting every single person who knew the man, firsthand accounts of him at that time, or people he served with on the police force and best friends and his wife's hairdresser, everybody we could, you know, find. And really, he was a very complicated person. So there were several things that fed him. But I know from his discussions in the late nights in prison with Alan Hale, as well as his defense on the stand, that the time he spent on the riot squad in Tembisa, which is the northeast township of Johannesburg, where in the name of duty, they were essentially demanded to commit murder, you know, so they were firing live ammunition at unarmed student protesters. And this, in the film, it's crystallized into a single dramatic sequence, but in fact, this time went on for months and months and years for some people. That period was made him such a shell of a man that he never quite got over it. And as Alan Hale put it, he said the penny dropped for Andre during that time. So his defense on the witness stand was that although I'm here on trial for robbing banks, I've killed unarmed people. And nobody seemed interested in that.
Give us one of his more colorful heists.
Well, at a certain point, they found out that a task force had been established to catch them because they'd been at it for so long. And when Andre, this is Alan Hale, the only surviving member of the Stander gang who's still in prison in South Africa and my very, very best contact for all of these stories. But he told me that they were reading the newspaper about the task force and saw a photo of the building. And Andre leaned into the photo and he said, I know this building. And right next door was, in fact, a bank, which they decided to rob. So they robbed a bank in the same building as their very own task force.
And got away with it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
There's some suggestion in the film, which you've made, that he at least some of the money he took went to the poor. I mean, I think the first job he drops a packet of bills on a black kid selling newspapers on the street. Is there any evidence that he was sort of a Robin Hood character?
Well, in fact, some people thought that that's the film they were in for. But we don't really have that sense. And in fact, if you watch Thomas's performance, Thomas Jane, who's playing Andre Stander in the film, his performance in that is more or less to discard of this filthy money that has come of this radical thing he's just done. It's not so much that he seeks out a needy person and lays it on the young newspaper boy in an act of grand charity, nor does he give it away after that moment. He spends it. It's not so much, I don't believe he was a pro-black person, or I don't believe that his upset was really about the inequality so much as the idea that he himself would be demanded something so outrageous, so something so compromising to his own moral barometer, his own moral sense, that and he would have no say in the matter. It was, I think it really began in that ego place, less than I shall right the wrongs of the haves and have-nots, you know. So it's not a Robin Hood story so much.
I read of a couple of Associated Press accounts of Andre Stander that were written in the 80s, and they seem to indicate that he was just a bank robber, that he lived a very flamboyant lifestyle, but that his father said that he was motivated by the pain he'd experienced as a riot cop in black townships.
Well, like I said, that would be an evidence of the press owned by the government who was made to look bad by all of his exploits. So I would consider that one of the classically slanted reports, although at the same time, I'm not saying the man was a saint at all. He enjoyed spending the money, finally, and I do believe he was driven in the later years by the infamy, the fame, and the idea that he could live a lifestyle that, as a hard-working cop in South Africa, he wouldn't even come close to. So, I mean, his ego was very much a part of it. However, I do think the father has grounds in what he said based on what Alan Hale has told me in their long discussions.
Alan Hale being the surviving member of the gang, right? Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. The only one of the Stander gang still alive. And actually, it was a coup for me to find that Alan was still there. In all these years of people trying to tell the story, no one had gone to speak to him.
Why do you think he spoke to you?
Well, he didn't want to speak to me. In the first place, you know, I had to kind of work my way into the prison by less than overt means. The doors of the prison system in South Africa don't fly open to you when you announce that Hollywood is calling. You know, it's like you will be shut out before they'd be letting you in, you know. But I managed to meet him as a sort of, you know, legal consultation, sort of legitimate, you know, that's the kind of meeting that you can have. And he was reluctant because everything that had ever been written about him talked about what a thug he was, what a brute, how they were just greedy and violent, and yet there was nothing known about his political leanings and the fact that he has 2 degrees and the fact that his disgust with the system that was, what he told me once was that as a student of the teacher college, he was taught every day that he was the chosen people, and it didn't sit well with him to the point where he wouldn't go anymore. And
this is Alan Hale you're talking about, not Stander,
yes.
But Alan Hale.
No, not Stander, this is Alan. Alan finally sensed, I guess, the sincerity of my questions and the fact that I'd done enough firsthand research to not be believing the things I'd read in the press, and he started to open up to me. And he recounted for me everything that a director or a performer trying to, you know, embody these characters would need to know in so, so many ways. How they did it, what they said while they were doing it, what the bank teller said to them while they were being robbed, the political thinking behind it, the adrenaline pump, the sheer rush of robbing banks five in a row and getting away with it, and then the wave of abject fear that came over them at the end of a day when it hits you what you've really done, as well as the sinking feeling, the sort of hollowness that comes when you realize you've crossed a line and there's no turning back and your life can only be on a downward spiral. And all of these things, you know, were in both of them, I think, through the years of robbing banks. So, you know, he was really in the mode of confession when I met him.
It seemed credible, yeah.
Were
they a violent group?
Their mission was to rob banks invisibly, or at least their style, their MO, was to go in and out of a bank and rob it before anybody even realized there'd been a robbery. In fact, on occasions, there would be the guard holding the door for them on the way out. Thank you very much, gentlemen, which we have in the film once or twice. So, you know, they have loaded weapons. That makes it a violent crime. But their goal was not to hurt people, was not to shoot people. Really, that was their interest. It did, however, start to go wrong. A woman was shot in a gun shop robbery, which is in the film, actually. And at that moment, they lost a lot of popular support and never quite recovered.
In the case of the woman, she pulled a weapon on them, right? And they fired in self-defense, so to speak?
Well, self-defense, you know, they had loaded weapons out. But, yes, she pulled the gun from under the counter, which is a gun shop, you know, so inevitably there'll be guns. She was shot in the shoulder, and the quote when she was interviewed, she said something like, "Andre Stander has very nice legs."
No, really?
Clearly
after she
charmer.
Was shot? After she
yeah.
was shot?
There was an interview with her. "What do you remember about Andre Stander, ma'am?" "I remember he has very nice legs." So, you know, he was a charmer.
There was a third character in the Stander gang who ultimately was killed in a shootout with police, I gather. Was he the one involved in the shootout with the woman?
Yeah, Lee McCall was the loose cannon of the three. Lee had not meant to stick around with the gang after the escape from prison. He was kind of necessary to them in that in the escape, they would have never have let Stander and Hale go off the prison site together because they were always, you know, they were hanging around and they would have suspected something. So they needed someone unsuspectable, like Lee McCall, if that's a word, to complete the escape, which he did. And the idea was they would all go, or he would go his separate way after the escape. However, he was such a lost dog, like a loyal dog sort of thing, that he never sort of disappeared. And I don't know if they felt sorry for him or what, but he just kept hanging around and ended up with them, you know, game for anything that they could invent, any kind of ante they could up, and ended up robbing banks with them all along. But he would constantly do things that would jeopardize them, like wear loud and flashy clothes that were not exactly invisible in a bank robbery. You know, this is with his rash behavior, certain things started to go wrong, which put an end to the spree, really.
You said you spoke to many people who knew Andre Stander firsthand. Just give us a little bit of a sense of what some of them said to you about him.
The funny thing about researching with people who say they know Andre Stander was that every person I met described someone radically different. So I would talk to someone who was on the drug squad with him, and they would talk about how he could, you know, he could become a hippie. And then the next person I would meet would describe how he was such a sophisticated host and had the best wine collection of anyone in the whole South African police force. And then the next person I'd met would talk about how he used to go whoring in Swaziland, you know. And there's funny stories like the rugby team from South Africa was staying in a hotel in Durban, and he went to this hotel where they were all in the bar with some lovely ladies, and he asked the star player of the team to borrow his jacket, and he put on this guy's jacket, which of course has his name on it, and convinced some girl in the bar that he was that star player and got laid. So I'm not a saint by any means, but the point was that everybody described a character that was not the same loving husband of the last description. And I thought, oh, well, these people are either all lying or there's something going on here. And ultimately, I realized that Andre Stander was all of those things. And that was the key to his character, and our characterization is what we aimed for, the ultimate chameleon. He could be whoever he needed to be in any given situation.
My guest is filmmaker Bronwyn Hughes. Her latest film is Stander. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with filmmaker Bronwyn Hughes. Her latest film is Stander. It's about Andre Stander, who was a South African police captain who eventually left the force and started robbing banks back in the 70s and 80s. Well, Bronwyn Hughes, one of the most remarkable scenes in this movie, and a pivotal one, is the confrontation between South African police and angry protesters in Tembisa. Tell us about staging that scene.
Well, the Tembisa riot scene was, from the first time I read the script, the most daunting and also delicious prospect for a filmmaker in the entire script. There was an enormous weight on it, creative weight, in that if you didn't feel anything for Andre Stander in that moment, in that time, you wouldn't care what he did for the rest of the 2 hours of the film. Second of all, production-wise, it was enormous. We had production meetings that treated it like a film within a film, really. They don't have movie dogs in South Africa. They have attack dogs. So if we're staging a dog attack, you know, there isn't the kind of guarantee that you normally have that everything will go right. And one of the amazing things about the scene was that we were asking these people, 1,300 South Africans, to reenact their very recent, very emotional and very raw and painful history on one side of the line or the other, either the township people, the black people on the crew, or the township people who I was interviewing to gather their stories and gather their experiences, or even the white kids that had been on their mandatory military service, like a pimply-faced teenager holding a gun and not really knowing what to do with himself faced by a mob like that, you know. So we were saying, okay, now do this for the movie camera. And, you know, there were security concerns. Would it go off? Would the emotions take over? In fact, the fear of that was unfounded. This was the most committed, most energetic, most realistic group of extras I've ever worked with. It was amazing. And the emotional swell of reenacting the Toy Toys where they do the protest songs had the crew with wet eyes. It was just like nothing I've ever experienced.
The actual clash, the violent clash between the protesters and the police, is preceded by this period of awkward tension at which they actually look into each other's eyes and try and figure out what's going to happen, how they should react. I thought that was an interesting approach to sort of prolong that period.
Oh, good. Well, one thing I decided from the very beginning with this riot scene was I didn't want to make it a montage of generic chaos. There are some very good films that have riot scenes in them. But I've always found that you couldn't really connect with the human experience of them because you just saw destruction and you kind of grow numb to it. So one thing that happened was that with this researcher's finds, this footage, old film footage, some video footage from the 80s that has not been seen by most South Africans because it would have never been on TV. Clips of it now can be seen in the Apartheid Museum, but that's the most, I think, that's been out there. I would get to watch the raw footage of the events. I would get to see the event unfold and disintegrate and feel the rhythms of what that was. And the thing that I was most struck by is that the tension for me was in the moments when neither side knew what the other was going to do. As the years went by, certain patterns started to be expected, the way the confrontation would begin and how they would disintegrate. But in these early years, when the film takes place, there was no real system. There was no real idea on what might happen. And I think most of the young students wouldn't have even suspected that they were, you know, going to be faced with something, with live rounds of ammunition, for example. So when these videotapes had the pauses between watershed events, like the first stone thrown or the dog first launched or the first sniper bullet, that's when I felt, oh, my God, my heart rate was pumping, not knowing what was going to happen next. And I thought if we can capture anything like that, we would have something very visceral.
I think one of the things that I found compelling was this: after he has this shattering experience doing riot control work, his wife comes upon him standing naked with stereo headphones on in his house, dancing wildly to music. We see a guy kind of coming unhinged, don't we?
Yeah, that was, you know, when you dramatize something like that, of course it's a longish process, but you have to find these clues, these ways into seeing what he's going through, his emotional state. And the idea that he would be just naked and thrashing about in the living room as if trying to forget the world seemed to be a good way to do that. And that's exactly what his wife comes across, and she's much more together than him at that time in the story. And that was Thomas throwing himself body and soul into the role. I can't tell you what an actor he is to do things like that.
You mentioned that you interviewed Alan Hale, the last surviving member of the Stander Gang. You interviewed him in prison. What is his fate?
Well, Alan is serving a 33-year sentence in Krugersdorp Prison outside Johannesburg. And really, in meeting him, I was very, very impressed. I thought I was going to meet a thug, which is what I'd read about, you know, in the media. But he turned out to be a very deep-thinking man who spent the last 20 years in prison in self-examination, basically trying to come to terms with the angry young man he once was and come out the other side. I don't know how you survive so far 2 decades of lockup at 2 in the afternoon, only to be opened at 7 a.m. with no books allowed to be brought in, no films, no, you know, no movies, no television. They are allowed so, so few privileges there, and yet he is still so dignified, I guess is the best word. His advisors and his psychologists all recommend his release, but somehow with violent crime being such a problem in South Africa right now, they can't really see fit to release him on parole, which is due by now.
Well, Bronwyn Hughes, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Director Bronwyn Hughes. Her new film is called Stander. Coming up, Milo Miles on a new box set retrospective of the British rock group Faces. This is Fresh Air. They were called by many the greatest rock and roll party band ever. The group Faces was formed in 1969 when members of the mod rock band Small Faces and the Jeff Beck Group got together. The British troupe frequently toured America. Although some members of Faces achieved fame on their own, the group itself remains relatively unknown. But a new box set could change that. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
You know Faces even if you've never heard the band. The drummer, Kenny Jones, had the thankless but exciting job of trying to replace the whirlwind Keith Moon in The Who. The guitarist, Ron Wood, has been the only person to hang on as second picker for the Rolling Stones. And the singer, this Rod Stewart guy, didn't he have a hit, Do You Think I'm Sexy? Yeah. The bassist was Ronnie Lane, probably the finest overlooked player and songwriter of the first generation of British rockers. Finally, the keyboardist, Ian McLagan, is a hugely respected session man, though one of his finest achievements of late is putting together the Faces box set, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar. The song Stay With Me was their only hit in the U.S., but Faces' real accomplishment was perfecting rock and roll party ambience. At the start, as McLagan says, they had no direction, just influences. They sounded most like the Rolling Stones, but like all the mid-period Stones albums played together, blues, soul, folk, and pure rock. The secret was to be as offhand as possible and on target just enough, particularly in concert. Faces literally set up a bar on stage and quaffed drinks throughout the show. But it was more of a prop than sodden legend would have it. A Faces performance was part circus, part cabaret, part sock hop, and yes, part pub crawl. The four LPs released in the band's lifetime mostly wobbled all over the place. Not this box. With brilliant programming of live shots, vivid rehearsals, and their best studio work, McLagan keeps four CDs rolling along the edge of lunacy without falling off. He displays a group whose feel for each other perfectly matched their feel for the diverse material. Best of all, Five Guys Walk Into a Bar solves the Rod Stewart problem. Here at last is a faces set where he sounds like a terrific, gregarious frontman rather than a superstar stuck with some mates in the off hours. Ron Wood gets a proper showcase for his spiky slide guitar. And most important, those who don't know him will get to meet Ronnie Lane, the big, sensitive heart of Faces. Because he wasn't much of a vocalist, Lane didn't get to sing enough of his own songs, and he came to feel they weren't featured enough, period. As opposed to the preening, pouting studs and revelers in most Faces songs, Lane's characters are British everyfolk. He presents guys that are sly, vulnerable, escape artist lovers, and generous ruffians. Faces Pub would have been a bleak place without Lane, and he deserves to be better known. If I had to pick a hit Faces never had but should have, it would be Lane's Ooh La La.
Poor old granddad, I laughed at all his words. I thought he was a bitter man. He spoke of women's ways. The trap you'd and the use you before you even know. For love is blind and you're far too kind. Don't ever let it show. I wish
Five guys walk into a bar box includes testimonials from 70s punks and modern rock bands. But Faces should be recognized not for who they influenced, but for themselves. And as another wonderful example of how American roots music and British theatrical flair enriched each other.
Milo Miles is a contributing writer to Rolling Stone. He reviewed Five Guys Walk Into a Bar, the new retrospective box set by the British group Faces, produced by Faces keyboardist Ian McLagan. I recently spoke with Ian McLagan. We'll feature that interview next week on Fresh Air. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. By Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. And from Gotham Books, publishers of Almost French by Sarah Turnbull, based on the true story of one woman who finds adventure and the love of her life in Paris. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Barack Obama gave the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. He's regarded as a rising star in the party. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Obama, and we talk with the Republican who's challenging him for the Illinois U.S. Senate seat, Alan Keyes. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.